And a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson. This is the show that looks behind the headlines, talking to the correspondents who bring the stories to the front pages. Ahead in the next hour, what's the value of time as the clocks head backwards towards winter? In some parts of the hemispheres, we examine the effect of shifting time zones. What's it like to be kidnapped, we ask? Our correspondent talks to a man held hostage for 8 months by Somali pirates. And live on Midori House, the man who interviewed President Assad of Syria, Andrew Gilligan, joins us from Damascus. All that right here on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. NATO has ruled out the possibility of military intervention in Syria, but says Damascus should draw lessons from Libya, where NATO-backed rebels won a civil war that resulted in the killing of the long-serving leader Muammar Gaddafi. Speaking during a visit to the Libyan capital Tripoli, NATO Secretary-General Anas Fogh Rasmussen said military action in Syria was out of the question. Residents of heavily flooded areas of Bangkok waded through waist-high water today after another day of misery for many in the Thai capital. A residential and commercial area of Bang Plat district has been worst hit by flooding in recent days as water flowing down the central Chao Phraya River basin from the north met peak tide surging in the Gulf of Thailand, leading to fears the city's makeshift defences would be swamped. However, the Prime Minister, Yingluck Shinawatra, is hopeful the centre of the capital has escaped the worst of the rising waters.
Hopefully the sandbag is quite strong enough. So if the sandbag is not flow over, so it should be okay. We'll try our best.
Transportation in the northeast United States has been hard hit by a rare October snowstorm that also cut power to more than 2 million homes and killed at least 3 people. The heaviest snow was recorded in western Massachusetts, where 71 centimetres was measured in Plainfield, according to the National Weather Service. Jeff Butler from Connecticut Light and Power is asking customers to be patient.
We are continuing to encourage our customers to be prepared for lengthy outages. We do expect that some customers will be on a week or more.
The United Nations Cultural Agency, UNESCO, has decided to give Palestine full membership for the body, a vote that will boost their bid for recognition as a state at the United Nations. UNESCO is the first UN agency the Palestinians have sought to join as a full member since President Mahmoud Abbas applied for full membership of the United Nations on the 23rd of September. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney has said the vote to admit the Palestinians to UNESCO was premature and would not aid the search for peace between Palestinians and Israel. And some news just in, the United States says it has stopped funding UNESCO following its vote to grant the Palestinians full membership. Sudan's government said it repulsed a large attack by rebel fighters in an oil-producing southern border state today and accused South Sudan of supporting the insurgents. A spokesman for the Sudanese army said the rebels had received training in South Sudan. The report could not be independently verified. Finally, babies born in Russia's Far East and its western enclave Kaliningrad today were included in the United Nations Global Action to mark the world's population passing the 7 billion mark. Pyotr Alexeyevich Nikolaev, weighing in at 3.6 kilograms at a length of 50 centimetres, was born in Kaliningrad at 2 minutes past midnight local time, according to doctors and UN observers. Both he and his mother were pronounced to be healthy and in good condition. Catherine Raw from the charity Save the Children says tackling infant mortality rates will actually reduce population growth.
If women are more confident that their children will survive, they'll be able to plan for having smaller families, they'll be more confident that their children will grow up to, and will survive to be a healthy age and will be able to look after them in their future, and therefore they will have smaller families.
Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Nick. Now let's take a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
And let's start with that snowstorm in the northeast of the United States, an exceptional event that happens every few decades, at least this time of the year. So what can we expect in the next couple of days? Because the impact of this storm has clearly been very substantial. The storm is currently affecting Newfoundland and will be losing its power over the next day or two. The weather couldn't be any more different across the eastern half of the United States through Monday and into Tuesday. autumn sunshine for most, a rapid thaw in New England after all of that snow. One word of caution though, there could be some rough weather around Tuesday just off Virginia, Maryland and into Long Island. Looks like wind and rain, at least for the moment. In South Florida, meanwhile, thunderstorms giving through Monday, perhaps quite a lively atmosphere for the Halloween evening. So on to the business forecast then, Monday into Tuesday. Let's start with Toronto, sun and a few clouds, 14 degrees. New York City, skies have cleared, sun with just a few showers, 14 Celsius, that's on Monday. In Chicago, sunshine and 14 degrees as well. And in Los Angeles, it's that never-ending sunshine with temperatures up to 25 degrees in LA. Now, air travel, no recent delays due to the weather across the US. Much quieter conditions for the next day or two. Certainly nothing like the chaos over the weekend. In terms of the jet stream, it's raging like a monster just out of the very far east of Canada and the US. If you're jetting off to Europe, you'll certainly get a good push from this jet stream. Flight times are likely to be shorter, but plenty of turbulence all the way through, for example, into Heathrow. Let's go over to Europe now. Well, here in the UK, it's one of the mildest Octobers on record, certainly in the last 100 years or so. We seem to be breaking records everywhere. The coming days across the European continent will yet again be mild, as far north as Scandinavia, but more especially in Western Europe, where afternoon highs may reach 15 to 18 degrees, just like last week. So why is it so mild in Europe? The air across Europe in the past week or more has persistently been coming in from the warmer Atlantic and also the Mediterranean, and a powerful jet stream is driving this weather pattern. At this stage, there are no changes expected, at least not for the time being. Let's have a look at the business forecast then for Tuesday. And in London, it's a mixture of sun, clouds, perhaps a little light rain, 15 Celsius. In Paris, damp weather here for a time, 15 too. Frankfurt, mostly overcast at 14. And Madrid, expect showers around 16 Celsius. Air travel across Europe, it's looking generally quiet. Could be some foggy conditions in Central and Eastern Europe. The jet stream over the Atlantic, of course, very powerful. Monday and Tuesday, roaring at 300 kilometers an hour, just off of Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. It's that same part of the jet stream that has been responsible for that freak snowstorm in the United States. So if you're flying off to North America, you'll be flying way north of that jet stream, just south of Greenland, so it looks fairly quiet. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thomas Schaffernacker there with the global weather. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We've been joined in the studio by foreign editor Steve Bloomfield. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, Steve.
Hello.
Good to see you in the studio.
You.
We're moving on to the story that's been dominating the headlines for the last 24 hours to do with the Arab world, which is when President Bashar al-Assad of Syria spoke to the British paper The Daily Telegraph. It made headline news, not just in the United Kingdom, where the paper was based, but around the globe. An article by Andrew Gilligan paints a portrait of a leader relaxed in a seemingly low-security bungalow in Damascus, but unmoving when it comes to the issue of reform. More than 3,000 people have died since the attempted uprising began in March this year. Now, the author of this article, Andrew Gilligan, joins us live on the line from Damascus. Hello there, Andrew.
Hello there.
It appears we have a bit of a sound, a bit of a time delay on the line to Damascus, so you'll have to bear with us, I'm afraid, Andrew. Andrew, just take us. This has been quite a key development in terms of the publicity campaign of President Assad. Just take us through the process of getting the interview in the first place.
Well, it took place after several months of kind of approaches through the Syrian embassy in London. Mostly, but also through, in typical fashion, personal connections, people who knew people. I happened to know somebody who knew somebody else who knew somebody else who knew the president very well. So that's how it happened.
And did it happen, like you say, overnight after a long process, or were you given much warning about this? And tell us about the circumstances of actually meeting the president.
No, I didn't know it was going to happen until very soon, very shortly before it actually happened. I had hopes, but I didn't know. And basically what happened is the woman who arranged the interview picked me up in her own car. We drove for about 10 minutes. We turned down a sort of side street between some bushes, and we pulled up in front of a sort of fairly modest-looking villa, a bit like a suburban bungalow in England, and President Assad was waiting in the hall. There weren't any great visible rings of security, and there was no security checks. The guy had one sort of butler-like figure who brought his tea, and that was it. There were no flunkies. There were only the three of us together, Nick Needham, who runs the interview, and Assad in his study, sitting on leather sofas. It was all quite informal.
Andrew, this is Steve alongside Emma in the studio here. Why do you think President Assad granted this interview? I mean, and did you worry that there was a danger that he might come across as a reasonable chap just trying to do his best to reform his country?
Well, I mean, that is clearly the impression he wanted to present. Now, the fact is, he is not a stereotypical ranting Arab dictator. There's nothing of a Gaddafi about him in his personal behaviour and manner. It is possible to have a conversation to disagree with him. But clearly we cannot avoid the fact that 3,000 people have been killed by the security forces, including 187 children. And the question about Assad has always been, is he really committed to reform, or is he just giving the impression of being moderate and open and reasonable to play people along? And certainly a lot of Western governments, who were initially quite encouraged by him, have come to the latter conclusion. Been president for 11 years and been very much significant reform. That said, the regime, there's some justice, they have been doing some, they've enacted some things that Western critics have been calling for ages. But Human Rights Watch, for instance, last year issued a report calling for the end of the state of emergency. It has been ended. But the trouble is the deaths in Homs and Hama and elsewhere of all those people have raised the stakes, and what might have satisfied people last year, probably won't satisfy them now.
Is there a danger, though, in a situation like this, that as a journalist you can be essentially used by President Assad here in his PR campaign?
Well, of course. I mean, I think it's quite important to have to hear what somebody's got to say. I don't think you can refuse to hear what somebody's got to say on the grounds that they shouldn't be allowed to say it. You shouldn't be allowed to hear what they've got to say. But I think it was quite interesting to see how he didn't seem particularly prepared to give very much ground on further genuine political reform. We talked about Article 8 of the Syrian Constitution, which says that the Ba'ath Party, Assad's party, must lead, and he didn't sound as if he was prepared to change that really in substance. And obviously without that, there can be no kind of real democratic reform in Syria.
Well, despite the relaxed demeanour that you portray, when you started to push him on the human rights abuses and the number of deaths and basically the treatment of people in the city of Homs, etc., how far did you feel as if you could push him?
Well, I said what I just said to you. I said, look, frankly, some of the things you've done might have been good enough 18 months ago, but they're not now because the killings have raised the stakes. And he agreed with that in a sense. He said he admitted that many mistakes have been made by the security forces. He said something that most people might dispute, that they were all right now. All the operations now were only against terrorists. He wasn't. Again, I was able to push him. I said as well how most people thought that the reforms were too slow. He disagreed with that as well. He didn't seem to then going to lose his temper and order me out of the room, anything like that. He was pushed on all the key issues.
Now, you mentioned that just then, you mentioned the idea of him invoking the idea of terrorists. I mean, that gives the impression that he's invoking the fight against Al-Qaeda, which is something Gaddafi did, which is something effectively what every fading Arab despot seems to have been doing in the last few months. What did you think of his comments?
Yeah. Well, I think, he says the struggle is between Islamists and Pan-Arabists, which is his word for secularists. Clearly, that that is a card that every Arab leader who's in trouble has tried to play, saying that that the people who oppose me, are, I might be bad, but the people who come next are going to be worse. And it's not these words speak for themselves. I mean, I don't know enough about the opposition in Syria to be able to say that. I mean, obviously, Muslim group and Muslim Brotherhood is very heavily involved in the opposition, but they don't give me the impression, the people I've spoken to in the opposition, that they want an Islamic Republic in Syria. And if they did want such a republic, it would be a total disaster, because this is an ethnically and religiously quite heterogeneous country. It's got a substantial Christian minority, for instance. It's got Alawite minority, of course, with whom, including President Assad. It's got a Kurdish minority racially. It would be pretty disastrous if some kind of Islamist solution were imposed here. But I don't know if it's going to be. But clearly, that, that's a card Assad can play, and of course he's playing it.
Andrew, you're obviously still in Damascus now. What impact has the interview had there? I mean, has Syrian state media been playing any extracts from it? Has it had any proper coverage at all in Damascus?
People seem to have heard of it. Actually more than that. I mean, we went around yesterday speaking to people, and they say, they'd all heard it. They were, most, one of them said it was everywhere. People, lots of people talking about it. And clearly, I mean, most of my interviews yesterday were conducted with the government minder by my side. So they're not, even if they're against the president, they're not going to say that. They fit into that. They were heartened and encouraged by that kind of thing. Having said that, I do think that there is, and everybody I've spoken to on all sides agrees, the opposition, Western diplomats agree that there is a degree of uncoerced support for us back. He isn't totally hated by everyone. It's illustrative to compare the situation with Libya. I was in Libya before Gaddafi fall as well, in Tripoli, and the conditions were similar. We could, you had to go around with miners, so you could flip out of the hotel and talk to people on your own. And when you did that, people were pretty clear that they wanted to see the back of Gaddafi. It's a little bit more equivocal here, to be honest. I've been out on my own as well without miners, and people are more equivocal about it. I don't think Assad is as unpopular as Gaddafi. That's not to say he's not unpopular or that he hasn't done bad things, but the regime here is a little bit more solidly based than Gaddafi.
Andrew, when you talk about the fact that he's not hated and there is a level of popularity, and you also describe fact that...
Hold on, I said he wasn't hated as much as Gaddafi. That was my point. No doubt he is very much hated by the people, his family, the people he's killed and dying there. By a lot of the demonstrators in places like Homs, and indeed many other places, I'm sure.
And the combination of this tension between the supporters and the anti-Assad people, and also the fact that Syria isn't ethnically or religiously homogenous, is this what you think he meant by when he threatened an earthquake? Because it's quite it's the headline that has gone across the world.
No, I think that's right, and I think I'll say this as well. That is a fear that a lot of Western powers have. About intervention. You'll notice today that the NATO Secretary General has come out and said there is no prospect. We are not contemplating foreign intervention in Syria as we did in Libya. And lots of Western governments will say that as well. Again, there's very, very little appetite for Western intervention, and that is probably because they recognise the dangers of doing things. Having said that,